This is Colorado Edition from KUNC. On today's show, how a life-ending prescription set off a federal court battle.
That could have far-reaching consequences well beyond the issue of aid in dying.
And why an opportunity zone in Boulder has sparked controversy.
Plus, how prescribed burns can help protect our forests.
Most Westerners have never seen a prescribed fire. It's much more likely that they've seen a wildfire.
That's coming up.
It's Wednesday, September 11th. You're listening to KUNC's Colorado Edition, your daily look at news from around the state. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Henry Zimmerman. We've been thinking about the 2020 election this week as Democratic Senator and presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders visited Denver on Monday, and as the third Democratic presidential debate is coming up tomorrow.
And although the Republican Party's primary hasn't received nearly as much attention in this cycle, state parties made headlines this week with a surprising announcement. The state GOP parties of South Carolina, Nevada, Kansas, and Arizona have announced they will not be holding primaries for 2020. Those state Republican parties have committed all their delegates to President Donald Trump. So we were curious, could that happen in Colorado? We called up the Secretary of State's office to find out more, and we spoke with Judd Choate, the state election director for Colorado.
Under our law, a party can cancel their presidential primary if they don't have more than one candidate and the Secretary of State agrees to cancel it. So in this particular instance, both the Republican Party and the Secretary, Secretary Griswold, would need to both agree that canceling that particular presidential primary was in the interest of the citizens of Colorado, and I doubt seriously that those combination of factors would come together.
In terms of the presidential primary, are you expecting to hear any talk of doing that?
We haven't heard any talk of it, and in fact, the Republican Party for the state of Colorado has already declared one candidate besides President Trump to be a bona fide candidate, which is the language of the statute. That candidate is a person named Robert Ardini, and he submitted a form, one of our forms out of the Secretary of State's office called the State Party Presidential Primary Approval Form, and the party has approved him as a bona fide candidate. So all he has to do at this point is submit $500 or 5,000 signatures and a statement of intent, and he will be on the ballot for the March primary.
And so which Democrats have already submitted to be on Colorado's primary ballot?
We've only received one submission on the Democratic side so far, and that's Kamala Harris. She did submit paperwork, and it was signed by the state party, so she is also considered a bona fide candidate. So we have two on the Republican side, the president, and then Robert Ardini, and one on the Democratic side. All of that paperwork and forms, they all have to be into our office by December 9th of this year, so we've still got a couple of months, and we anticipate we'll get a lot more of those submissions, especially on the Democratic side.
Judge Choate, thank you so much for joining us and for clearing up some of this information.
I'm happy to help.
So it looks like Colorado will host both Democratic and Republican presidential primaries in 2020. But that doesn't mean that the presidential race in Colorado won't look different this cycle from years past. Here to discuss the upcoming race in Colorado is Seth Maskett, the director of the Center on American Politics at the University of Denver. Seth, welcome back to Colorado Edition.
Thanks for having me on.
For the first time in a while, Colorado is going to be holding a presidential primary instead of a caucus. Can you kind of explain to us how this is different and maybe give us a little bit on why you think the state made the decision to hold the election this way?
Well, caucuses are simply much more time consuming. They take up several hours on a weeknight, and as opposed to a primary, which really you're checking a box, which you can do from home and mail in the ballot in a few minutes. So because caucuses are so time-consuming, fewer people participate in them. And the people who participate in them tend to be somewhat younger, somewhat wealthier. They're less likely to have kids. They're more likely to be white than your typical primary electorate. That favors some candidates more than others. And it's not always obvious who that candidate is going to be. It helps if the candidate has a very enthusiastic base of supporters. So on the Democratic side, for example, the caucus states came out very strongly for Barack Obama in 2008. It works well for candidates whose supporters feel like they're part of a movement rather than part of a campaign. And it worked very well for Bernie Sanders supporters in 2016. The switch to a primary means that there'll be other people. There'll be higher turnout, and you'll tend to see an electorate that is probably a little more poor, a little more non-white, and maybe a bit older. This isn't necessarily as favorable to Sanders as the caucus would have, although it's not really obvious this far ahead of time who that advantage is.
Colorado has a primary law that allows, of course, for unaffiliated voters to choose which primary they want to participate in. Do you have any thoughts on how you think that might play out this year?
That could be particularly fascinating this year in the sense that Colorado already has a very large number of unaffiliated voters, more than a third of the registered voters in the state. Quite a few of them are paying close attention to this presidential race. And we could really see some very interesting moves there, what's often called party raiding. That is, people who lean one party might end up wanting to participate in the other party's nomination contest. So there could easily be a situation where Republicans are very confident that Donald Trump will win the nomination, but they decide they want to cast a vote in the Democratic contest, either to pick someone that they like or to pick someone who they think would be less electable. We could also see Democrats who've been largely saying in surveys this year that they don't particularly care who the Democratic nominee is. They're going to vote for that person, but they might want to cast a vote in the Republican primary, to cast a vote against Donald Trump in that contest. The raw materials for party raiding along those lines are probably more present here than they have been in most other years.
Seth Maskett is a professor of political science and director of the Center on American Politics at the University of Denver. Seth, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Now let's take a look at today's headlines.
The field of Democrats hoping to unseat U.S. Senator Cory Gardner continues to shrink. John Walsh, Colorado's former U.S. attorney, dropped out and endorsed former Governor John Hickenlooper. Walsh is the second Democrat to quit this month after Hickenlooper's entrance into the race. Last week, former State Senator Mike Johnston bowed out, saying he wanted to avoid a negative primary campaign. There are still 10 candidates left in the Democratic primary, including former Colorado House Speaker Andrew Romanoff and State Senator Angela Williams.
The Estes Park Board of Trustees voted unanimously to schedule a special election this winter on allowing marijuana dispensaries in town. Those in favor of the ordinance say it would increase tax revenue and create jobs. Those opposed say that opening dispensaries will ruin the character of Estes Park and could lead to a larger drug problem. The election is scheduled for December 10th.
Nearly half of states and roughly 2,000 local governments have agreed to a tentative settlement with OxyContin maker Purdue Pharma over the toll of the nation's opioid crisis. State attorneys general are offering mixed opinions. Colorado AG Phil Weiser said the state has not agreed to any settlement with Purdue Pharma or the Sackler family. We have calls out to several Colorado counties and the Denver City Attorney's Office, and we'll update this story when we know more.
In November of 2016, Colorado voters passed the End of Life Options Act that allowed individuals with certain conditions to voluntarily end their life using medical aid in dying.
And Colorado's law is unique from other states with similar laws in a big way. The law prohibits healthcare facilities from punishing doctors who choose to or choose not to provide this care to patients. That made it surprising when a healthcare provider fired a Colorado doctor at the end of August for attempting to get an end-of-life prescription for a patient, a decision that has now set off a federal court battle. Matthew Winia, the director of the Center for Bioethics and Humanities at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus, joined us to discuss this a little more. He began by describing what happened between Centura Health Corporation and Dr. Barbara Morris.
Dr. Morris is a geriatrician at Centura Health System, which is a religiously affiliated hospital that has a policy that says they will not allow any of their employed physicians to participate in medical aid in dying. She has a patient, and she believes in her professional and personal and spiritual belief is that he qualifies and should be able to have access to this prescription. And she would like to be able to write the prescription for him, but her hospital says you can't do that. So she and her patient sued Centura to allow them to be able to participate, and Centura fired her because of that.
With Colorado's law saying that the hospital can't opt out, did they have the legal grounds to do this?
Well, that's probably why they moved it to the federal court. Because under Colorado law, the answer is probably no. They did not have the right to fire her because they don't have the right to punish or dismiss someone for participating in the law. But under federal law, they can argue that they have religious rights under the First Amendment to the Constitution, and that that Colorado provision is preventing them from the free exercise of their religion as an institution. So they moved it to the federal courts so that they could make this constitutional challenge. Rather than arguing we have the right to fire Dr. Morris, they said we have the right to fire Dr. Morris because the Colorado law is unconstitutional.
And this is something that we've been seeing a lot lately with the Trump administration broadening the ability of providers to refuse to participate in medical interventions or procedures that they object to.
And in that regard, this is a very interesting case because it's in some ways the opposite of what normally happens with so-called conscience cases. Usually the healthcare professional is saying, I don't want to participate in writing a morning after pill or abortion or aid in dying or doing a tubal ligation. There are a variety of things that people would say, as an individual, I have religious beliefs that prevent me from participating. And even though my employer allows those things to happen, I don't want to be a part of it. This is kind of the opposite, where the individual doctor is saying, I want to be a part of this. I feel it's my professional duty to do this. And the employer is saying, we don't care what you think as an individual, as an organization, we don't do this. So it really pits the conscience rights of an individual doctor against the conscience right of the organization.
What are the implications of the lawsuit for Colorado?
So I'm not a lawyer, but I would think that if this were to, you know, if it went through the court system and the doctor's right to participate in the law were to be upheld, that would really be a major challenge to religiously affiliated healthcare organizations, because it would be saying that individual conscience rights trump the conscience rights of organizations. That could have far-reaching consequences well beyond the issue of aid in dying, right? Because there are many organizations, more than a third of Colorado's healthcare organizations are religiously affiliated, and many of them prevent their employed doctors from doing things like carrying out tubal ligation or writing prescriptions for birth control pills. And if this were to uphold the right of the doctor to practice as she pleases, as she believes is appropriate, it would be a serious blow to religiously affiliated organizations.
What are you going to be watching for as this lawsuit moves forward?
Well, one thing is what the arguments are that Centura is making. And it seems clear already that they are going to be making arguments not based on whether the Colorado law prevents them from firing this doctor. It almost certainly does. They've sort of accepted that, it sounds like. Mm-hmm. And instead, they're going to argue that the Colorado law is unconstitutional. So I think I'm going to be very interested in how the courts look at the religious rights of this individual doctor as compared to the religious rights of the organization that hired her and that pays her salary. This is a very interesting case because it really puts those right up against each other. And I'll be very interested to see whether the court feels there's a way to split the difference somehow between the right of the individual doctor and her conscience and the right of the organization to live up to its, you know, religious precepts.
Dr. Matthew Winia is the director of the Center for Bioethics and Humanities at University of Colorado's Anschutz Medical Campus. Dr. Winia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Colorado Edition from KUNC.
Attempts to take advantage of a new tax incentive program called an Opportunity Zone in Boulder have stalled due to a development moratorium, creating tension about the future growth of the city.
Here to walk us through what's going on is Lucas High, a reporter for BizWest. Lucas, welcome back to Colorado Edition.
Thanks for having me back.
All right, let's start here. What are Opportunity Zones?
Opportunity Zones are a relatively new program. They're actually developed as part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, and while that was a pretty partisan debate over that particular tax cut, the Opportunity Zone program was actually had some pretty bipartisan support. And essentially what it does is allows for investors to realize certain capital gains tax incentives if they invest in development projects within what are deemed to be economically distressed areas. So essentially, at its most basic, it's a program designed to encourage development in less well-off parts of the country.
And why are they so controversial?
The controversy partially arises because of a lack of real data as far as what their impacts are. So critics of the program argue that investors will simply use the program to get tax breaks on projects that they otherwise would have done even if they didn't get the incentives. And the concern is that these projects won't actually have real community benefit. Rather, they'll contribute to sort of the exacerbation of ongoing gentrification in certain areas.
Still some things up in the air, but take us to Boulder. I mean, can you tell us what's going on there?
In February, Boulder implemented a development moratorium within its designated opportunity zone, which essentially means that if you are a property owner within the zone, you are actually unable to build a new business or expand your business. And part of the reason Boulder City Council opted to do that is the council has this ongoing priority to help rectify what the city calls its housing jobs imbalance. And essentially what that means is that there are too many jobs in Boulder and too few houses, which makes it difficult for folks to afford housing. So the concern with the Opportunity Zone would be if developers rushed in there and demolished existing housing and replaced it with office space, that would actually hurt the jobs housing imbalance rather than help it. So they've put this moratorium in place that essentially halts development within it. And there was some hope that there would be some movement last week to repeal the moratorium, which is supported by both the business and the development community. However, you know, after a long, long discussion amongst the city council members, members of the development community, city planning staff last week, they kind of punted on that. And the future of that moratorium sort of remains up in the air right now.
And what do we know about the kind of reactions to the moratorium we've been seeing, both from businesses and especially residents?
Well, the business community, it's pretty simple. They want the moratorium to be rolled back so that, you know, businesses can expand within the zone, or, you know, folks can build new businesses if they'd like to. The community reaction has been a little bit more mixed. Housing affordability advocates are generally a little bit wary of any move that would result in fewer housing options. So meaning if apartments or affordable multifamily unit projects were replaced with office space or more commercial projects, they're generally not in favor of that.
What's next for the city of Boulder?
Well, that's kind of up in the air. There hasn't been any additional items scheduled on future city council meetings related to the moratorium or any other amendments to the city's land use table. And it's really unclear as to what the appetite among city leaders are to revisit this before the election, which is scheduled for November.
Lucas High is a reporter for Biz West. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Henry.
Yesterday, we told you about using drones as a tool to help fight the impacts of wildfires and climate change. Today, we're going to go more in depth with another tool, prescribed burns.
A recent study says the American West should be doing more prescribed burns to keep forests healthy and to help lessen the impacts of wildfires across our region. It also concluded there needs to be a change in how we out here perceive the practice for that to happen. For KUNC, Noah Glick has more.
Let's go back about 75 years to a famous catchphrase.
Remember, only you can prevent forest fires.
The Smokey Bear ad campaign began in 1944. It was part of an effort by the U.S. Forest Service to communicate to the public that fires as a whole were bad. At the time, the agency's fire management policy stated that all wildfires needed to be suppressed by 10 o'clock the morning after they're first spotted.
The historical legacy is what really is driving sort of the modern trends.
That's Crystal Colden, an associate professor of fire science at the University of Idaho. Part of that legacy, she says, is the Great Fire of 1910. That blaze burned 3 million acres in northern Idaho and western Montana, with smoke being seen as far away as New York State. And it was this perception of fire that stayed in the American consciousness for much of the 20th century.
You know, it's the death and destruction image of fire.
She says while aggressive fire suppression techniques were underway in the West, the southeastern region of the U.S. was trying something else.
They started using prescribed fire in the southeast, actually not to reduce wildfire risk, but to improve habitat for species that they like to hunt.
Colden says that's helped to change the public sentiment around the practice in that region, where they see fires as an intentional process to control the landscape.
And it's the exact opposite in the West. Most Westerners have never seen a prescribed fire. It's much more likely that they've seen a wildfire.
Colden recently published an article in the journal Fire. In it, she states that other areas of the country are increasing usage of prescribed fires, including a rise across Indian country. But in the West, the practice has been decreasing. And she says that's a problem.
Science has only increased in its findings that prescribed fire is not only a very good way to mitigate wildfire risk, but that it's actually really a necessary component for healthy ecosystems.
That might sound counterintuitive, but think of it this way. Prescribed fires burn grass, brush, and undergrowth, things that help fuel wildfires. These controlled burns also provide the heat needed for things like sequoia and redwood trees to crack open their cones and release seeds. But they also come with risk.
Embers from smoldering brush ignited the Little Valley Fire.
The Little Valley Fire began south of Reno in fall of 2016 following a prescribed burn. High winds in the area carried embers from that blaze, which ignited a wildfire. By the end of it all, it burned nearly 2,300 acres and destroyed 23 homes. The Nevada Division of Forestry was in charge of the controlled fire and was later found guilty of gross negligence. This year, the division reached a $25 million settlement with victims. Casey Casey is the state forester.
Even with the best intentions and the best written plan, things can still go wrong.
Casey says since the Little Valley Fire, the division has rewritten its policies concerning prescribed fires to plan for bigger environmental impacts than they previously had predicted.
It's a different environment now. With climate change, with the current condition of our forests and our rangelands, you can expect a lot more of these extreme environmental wind impacts.
Planning a prescribed burn is pretty complex, as is. Casey says land managers look at dozens of variables, from relative humidity to wind conditions to the desired fuel to be burned, and of course, contingency plans in case anything goes wrong.
The planning process usually needs to start almost a year in advance. There's a lot of modeling that needs to go on. There's a lot of thought that needs to go into it. There's a lot of coordination.
And then you've got to have the right conditions. Casey says oftentimes plans sit dormant for years because the weather just isn't right for a burn. It's all very complicated, and as Ryan Elliott says, controlled burns will never be a silver bullet. Elliott is a fire investigator for the Bureau of Land Management, and he does say there is one simple fix. Most fires are started by humans, so...
do whatever you can to not start them. And that sounds like a glib answer, but it's the truth.
So maybe after 75 years, we still have something to learn from Smokey Bear. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Noah Glick.
KUNC is a member of the Mountain West News Bureau, a regional reporting collaboration. You can find more stories at KUNC.org. One last thing before we go. Today is the 18th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks in New York City and Washington, D.C. Every year, firefighters from across the state gather at Red Rocks Amphitheater for the 9/11 Memorial Stair Climb. It's one of more than 40 stair climbs held around the world. Henry, you went to the event this morning. Talk about what you saw.
At first, it kind of felt like I was going to see a classic rock band's reunion show. The line was really long and parking was hard to find, but I eventually parked and I made it to the line myself, and things were obviously a lot different than a rock show. Half the folks in line were wearing bunker gear, which is the name of the equipment that firefighters wear. And each firefighter was carrying this badge that had the name and the photo of a firefighter who lost their life during the events of 9/11. So I eventually made my way through the line up the stairs to the amphitheater, and I bumped into a group of students from Windsor High School. They were there with their PE teacher, Carly Uliberry, who had been prepping them in class for the high altitude workout. Here's what she told me when I asked why she decided to bring her students.
A lot of these students weren't around when 9/11 happened. We're at that point where people, even who are seniors, weren't even born. So I wanted to give them the experience to really see and feel the emotion firsthand that they won't get really anywhere else.
And though it was kind of hard to talk to firefighters during the climb, I did get the chance to speak to one who was from the City of Golden Fire Department, and he was willing to share his thoughts about the walk. Here's that.
The walk is not about fitness. It's not about speed. It's about consideration. It's about challenge. It's about, you know, being pensive and thinking about the sacrifice that those firefighters made. Us doing the same, I don't think is too much to ask. It's not. It's honestly, it's not that hard, and I'm doing it for my brothers. So.
That same firefighter also told me that he's been doing the climb each year since it started, and he plans to do it each year going forward until he physically can't.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Colorado Edition, we'll revisit a failed experiment in nuclear fracking 50 years later. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Henry Zimmerman. Our show is produced by Lily Tyson, and Brian Larson is our executive producer.
Thanks for listening. This is Colorado Edition from KUNC.